Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Stephanie Prentice, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 10th of July, these are our main stories. The British Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt accuses President Trump of being disrespectful and wrong after his Twitter tirade against the UK. The two contenders to be the next British Prime Minister trade barbs over Brexit in a live TV debate. And France puts a Saudi Arabian princess on trial, charged with ordering her bodyguard to beat a workman. Also in this podcast... It's the end of the road for the Volkswagen Beetle. Yet again, someone who's criticised President Trump is now facing the full force of a presidential Twitter tirade. The British ambassador in Washington, Sir Kim Darroch, has been described by the president as a very stupid guy. Mr. Trump also repeated his view of Prime Minister Theresa May's Brexit strategy, calling it foolish. The tweets follow the leak of private cables from Sir Kim, in which he said the White House was dysfunctional, clumsy and inept. The British Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt has called President Trump's remarks disrespectful and wrong and has promised to keep the ambassador in place if he wins the Conservative leadership contest later this month, which would make him Theresa May's successor. But a former ambassador to the US, Lord Rennick, believes Sir Kim has to step down.
People in London will try to make the best of this. There'll be a decent interval, but he will have to be moved on. He's not going to be able to be effective as ambassador in Washington. That is not his fault. It's the fault of the leaker. And the leaker deserves to go to jail, because when you join the Foreign Office, see secret material, you have to sign the Official Secrets Act. And if you leak secret and confidential material, that is a matter for the law.
For reaction from Washington, I spoke to our correspondent there, Anthony Zerka.
This is par for the course for Donald Trump, I suppose. The American public is getting used to these sorts of spats with world leaders or with domestic opponents. And these tweets from today, they have a little bit of what we've seen in past Donald Trump tweets, which are, personal insults, second-guessing and criticism of the critic, and then ending with a certain amount of self-congratulations, boasting about the strength of the U.S. economy and the military, and then ended by thanking himself. So there is a certain amount of shrug your shoulders. This is what Donald Trump does, even though this is an ongoing dispute with, as Boris Johnson put it, the closest ally that America has.
You mentioned that relationship. Could this have long-term effects on the special relationship between the UK and the US, or will it all blow over?
Well, it depends. Theresa May is on her way out. There will be a new prime minister. And so that could be a reset for Donald Trump. And assuming the new prime minister ends up deciding to remove the ambassador, then he may move on. We've seen in the past Donald Trump to engage in these sorts of disputes, whether it's with domestic critics, campaign opponents in 2016, or even Kim Jong-un with North Korea, where it was fire and fury one moment and then their best buddies later. On. So, nothing seems to be permanent with Donald Trump, but at least in the short term, this is causing a fair amount of disruption in U.S.-British relations. And I think it also, for Donald Trump, it undermines what he tells the public time and time again, which is that he's helping to make the United States the most respected in the world it's ever been. Well, here you have an ambassador talking about how dysfunctional the administration is and how chaotic and incompetent it is. That may be one of the reasons why he has responded so strongly.
And quickly, some are suggesting that Donald Trump's reaction seems to prove the truth of what was said in those leaked emails, particularly about radiating insecurity.
Yeah, I mean, it is no big secret that there are some dysfunctional parts of this administration. It leaks a lot. There's infighting. There's disputes. There are changes, of course. All these things, for where we're fairly well characterized by the ambassador.
Anthony Zerka there. Here in the UK, the two rival candidates hoping to succeed Theresa May as Prime Minister, Jeremy Hunt and Boris Johnson, have gone head-to-head in an hour-long televised debate on ITV. They clashed over issues such as the Brexit deadline.
If you don't get us out of the EU by the 31st of October, will you resign?
We're going to come out on October the 31st. And I think anybody who goes into this negotiation proposing yet again to kick the can down the road will, I think, run the risk of forfeiting trust with the electorate, and also undermining our negotiating position in Brussels.
Could you answer Mr. Hunt's question?
Delay does not deliver a deal.
Julia,
a deadline will deliver a deal. And we must stick to that deadline.
I think it's a no. And what we've got is someone who says it's do or die for
the country. I'm sorry. I think what we have with
I asked you if you'd resign, Boris.
What I have with my opponent
is
somebody
will you resign if you don't deliver yes or no?
My opponent is clearly not committed to coming out of the EU on October the 31st.
I asked our political correspondent Rob Watson what he took from the debate.
I didn't take very much, to be absolutely frank with you, Stephanie. I mean, it was simultaneously rather feisty and tedious at the same time. I mean, you could get a sense of the feistiness there, but tedious in that the two candidates offered a lot of lines we've heard before during the leadership contest about how they would somehow get a better Brexit deal than Theresa May and leave the EU without one. But I don't think there was any clear winner. There were no knockout blows, no terrible gaffes either.
And you mentioned that they repeated some of the stuff that they've said before about Brexit deal. Was there anything that indicated that they might get a better Brexit deal than Theresa May did?
Not really, no. I mean, given that this is all about Brexit, I think there was precious new detail. I mean, what both men seem to be saying is that, look, there's a chance they will get a better negotiation with the EU just because they will show that they are serious about Britain leaving without a deal, the idea of a no-deal Brexit. But I think there are an awful lot of people, both in the UK and in the European Union, who are rather sceptical about why that would bring any better result.
And how much difference are these debates likely to make to who might become Prime Minister?
Do you know, I don't think it's going to make any. I mean, I think Boris Johnson went into this as the firm favourite. I think an awful lot of the 160,000 Conservative Party members you get to decide this, not the wider 45 million electorate. I think they've already voted and they've already made up their minds. But I think what was really interesting about this debate, that you see all the questions that were raised about how do you manage a post-Brexit relationship with the United States, with Donald Trump? What would you really do to prepare Britain for a no-deal Brexit? What will Britain's future relationship with the European Union be? You could see how incredibly difficult all this is going to be for the person who eventually does emerge the winner, almost certainly Boris Johnson, on drumroll, July the 23rd.
Our political correspondent, Rob Watson. The Russian President Vladimir Putin has ruled out a call by Parliament to impose economic sanctions on Georgia. Mr. Putin, who's already suspended direct flights between the two countries, said he wouldn't back sanctions out of respect for the Georgian people. Earlier, the Russian parliament unanimously supported a resolution calling for the measures. It followed weeks of anti-Russian protests in Georgia and a foul-mouthed outburst by a Georgian television presenter against Mr. Putin. Julian Marshall asked our Moscow correspondent Sarah Rainsford what the Russian reaction has been to that televised outburst.
It was really foul-mouthed. Every obscenity pretty much under the sun launched at Vladimir Putin. Very personal insult. So I think, you know, there was a good degree of reaction to that, certainly from state journalists, state-run media, and from politicians too in the Russian parliament. People calling for more sanctions against Georgia, calling for the journalist himself, in fact, even to be extradited to Russia and to be prosecuted. So the sort of semi-official response was definitely outrage. And the Kremlin too talked about it as a disgrace, say it was a dangerous fanning of anti-Russian hysteria and warning about potential consequences.
But President Putin, even though he was the object of all those insults, seems a little bit more relaxed about it?
Well, yeah, he's apparently chosen to play the statesman. He was approached by journalists, obviously, at an arranged kind of encounter in Ekaterinburg, where he was today on business. And someone, as if by chance, put him the question to him about Georgia. And he took the opportunity, really, to sort of play down the dispute and certainly to shrug off the insults. He was asked about the comments. He basically dismissed it as someone having blurted something out who just wanted to be noticed. And he said that this man had got what he wanted, but basically that Russia wasn't going to react. So he said, for the sake of relations with Georgia, for the sake of the people in Georgia who were actually protesting against that tirade by the TV presenter, that he didn't think Russia should do anything to further complicate relations. And certainly he didn't think that there should be extra economic sanctions against Georgia, as some MPs here have been calling for. They want a ban on the import of Georgian wine. They want Georgian mineral water to be banned from import to Russia, and also for a ban on remittances to Georgia from Russia. So big calls for big reaction, but President Putin, as I say, choosing really to shrug it off, to play it all down.
I mean, how unusual is it for Mr. Putin to overrule the Duma?
Well, the Duma isn't exactly an independent body. So, I mean, the fact is that it's up to the government and then ultimately the president to decide on sanctions. So whatever the statement was from Parliament, it's not up to them. They were calling on the government to introduce sanctions. They made this statement about anti-Russian provocations in Georgia. They talked about unfriendly actions. You know, in sort of the big theatre of Russian politics, you've got the Parliament saying this is outrageous and calling for a response, and President Putin able to sort of say, yes, it's outrageous, but hey, we're the big guys here, we're the big ones who can brush it off and ignore it and play peacemakers, at least for now, for as long as that suits both Vladimir Putin and Russia more broadly.
Sarah Rainsford. Mexico has agreed, under the threat of increasing tariffs on its exports, to reduce the flow of migrants to the United States. These are the terms of a deal President Andrés Manuel López Obrador made last month with his American counterpart. But critics say it's just one more example of Mexico doing America's bidding on immigration. The BBC's Ana Gabriela Rojas has been to Tapachula on Mexico's southern border with Guatemala to see the president's plan in action.
Salimos de mi país, Honduras.
We left Honduras because gang members got off two of my son's fingers. I've brought my three young children with me. We're only passing through Mexico to the USA, but the authorities have our papers. When they expire, they want to deport us.
This Honduran woman and her family have been stuck in Tapachula since January. They are the kind of people that President Trump wants Mexico to stop and send home before they get anywhere near the US border. The fate of the Mexican economy depends on the success of the government's actions. It has created the National Guard, which has now been deployed here on the southern border. They have been taking part in raids on places where migrants are staying. We saw four adults and five children from Honduras detained at a budget hotel.
A photograph brings home the human cost of the migration debate and sparks huge reactions.
The image in June of the Salvadoran father and his young daughter lying face down in water after they drowned trying to cross the Rio Grande into the U.S. is still fresh in people's minds.
Ordenando el flujo migratorio, respetando derechos humanos.
On a visit to the border, President López Obrador told us that the authorities are helping migrants escape such a fate and the clutches of people traffickers and criminals.
Lo que queremos es que no sufran, no padezcan.
We don't want them to suffer or lose their lives, and we are giving them special humanitarian treatment in Mexico because people don't migrate because they want to, but because they need to.
He added that Mexico was supporting economic development so that people didn't have to leave their own homes to find a better life.
Y ahora lo que se está haciendo es de que se está invirtiendo.
Now what is happening is that investments are being made in the south of Mexico, and also we are supporting investment, economic activity, and employment in Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, so that people have jobs and are not forced to migrate.
So far this year, Mexico has sent more than 75,000 migrants back to their countries of origin, mostly in Central America and the Caribbean. Critics accuse the president of doing Mr. Trump's bidding. Joseph Sadipun is a priest who worked with the migrants just across the border in Guatemala.
There is certainly a fear among the immigrants, seeing the reality of the militarization of the border, but they are persistent. They are going to continue coming to find a better future for themselves and their families.
People might have stopped on officially crossing the river from Guatemala, where the National Guard has been deployed. But there are reports that people are still coming across the border in other areas.
Ana Gabriela Rojas. Production of the VW Beetle, one of the best-known and most recognisable cars in history, has ended. The company's unit in Mexico was the last to manufacture the new Beetle, the original version stopped being made in 2003. The firm has chosen instead to manufacture a more popular SUV for the US market. Our Central America correspondent Will Grant reports.
After more than 80 years and millions of cars off the production line, the Volkswagen Beetle is about to become extinct. No more its humpbacked hood or its air-cooled rear engine. Gone its two-door design and famously weak horsepower. this is the end of the line for the much-loved vehicle. The Beetle has been on a long road from its conception between Ferdinand Porsche and Adolf Hitler as a people's car for Nazi Germany to the flower power colour schemes of the hippie generation and beyond. In that time, it became perhaps as synonymous with Mexico as it was with Germany. Production of the older version of the VW Beetle began to move from Wolfsburg to the company's factory in Puebla in 1967 and continued there until 2003.
Es bueno recordarlo. Volkswagen, la mejor compra.
The streets of the Mexican capital were dotted with the Vocho, as it's known in Mexico, with the Beetle the chosen model for the city's official taxis. Even once the original model was phased out, the car was kept alive in Mexico with a new, sleeker design, the new Beetle. While that maintained its production in Puebla until today, falling demand has done for the Beetle what it did many years before for the Ford Model T. Instead, the Puebla factory will take up production of the firm's SUV model, the Tarek, in 2020.
Our Central America correspondent, Will Grant. Still to come on this podcast.
Both Australia and America, those voices are clearly heard. One hopes that the electorate will actually respond to those.
Sir David Attenborough calls for greater awareness around the world about the risks from climate change. The Texas billionaire and two-time candidate for the US presidency, Ross Perot, has died at the age of 89. He was diagnosed with leukemia earlier this year. Mr. Perot rose to international attention when, as an independent candidate, he made a serious run for the White House in 1992. Here he is speaking during the second presidential debate of that election alongside Bill Clinton and George Bush.
I have lived the American dream. I came from a very modest background. Nobody's been luckier than I've been. All the way across the spectrum, and the greatest riches of all are my wife and children. Just as it's true of any family. But I want all the children. I want these young people up here to be able to start with nothing but an idea like I did and build a business.
With a focus on the economy and policies that would end the outsourcing of American jobs overseas, he won almost 20% of the vote. Julia Marshall spoke to Tom Luce, who was Ross Perot's campaign manager for that 1992 presidential campaign.
I met him first in 1974. He was already a successful entrepreneur, and I worked with him as his lawyer for over 30 years.
And how did he come across to you at the time?
Very articulate, visionary. He was a man way ahead of his time. He had formed a data processing company that was for the first time really combining hardware and software in ways to automate what had previously been pencil and paper business processes. And he really created an industry that we now call the information age. He was really ahead of his time.
What led Ross Perot to run for president in 1992?
I always think of Ross emerging out of a Norman Rockwell painting and living the American dream. And he cared deeply about the country. He was concerned about the direction of the country. And he felt strongly that there needed to be what he saw as an independent voice, independent of both political parties, to stimulate political debate.
And did he think at the time he had a realistic chance of winning? I suppose nobody enters a race without at least saying that, but privately, did he think that?
I don't know, but I do know that he was convinced that the country would be better off for the debate.
And how did he take his defeat?
Well, he was not used to being defeated in anything, but his favorite quotation was never give in, never, 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 the famous Winston Churchill quote. But I think he always accepted that the people had spoken. As you know, he did remarkably well as an independent candidate. He drew about 20% of the popular vote.
Do you think he was a forerunner of Trump-style politics? I mean, if not the man himself, he was a maverick businessman who spoke his mind and appealed to parts of the U.S. electorate previously neglected by the two main parties.
No, I really don't. I think his business success was really legendary. He knew how to organize. He was a visionary. I think if you look at the legacy of the companies he created, the industries he created, the people he helped, he'll be remembered more as a business person, humanitarian, and visionary leader.
Tom Luce there speaking to Julian Marshall. The sister of the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia has gone on trial in absentia at a French court over the alleged assault of a workman who was refurbishing her luxury apartment in Paris. Hassa bint Salman, the sister of Mohammed bin Salman, is accused of ordering her bodyguard to beat the man up after he took a picture inside her home in September 2016. Our Arab Affairs editor Sebastian Usher has been following the story.
It's quite a story. It dates back almost 3 years now. This is one of those really exclusive areas in Paris where the princess has an ultra-luxurious apartment. A man called Ashraf Eid, an Egyptian-born workman, was there repairing a basin. Now, there's no... I mean, all of those involved, the princess, Ashraf Eid and the bodyguard, all agree that a photo of some kind was taken. It's what happened after that, that there are differences. Ashraf Eid has essentially accused the bodyguard of using violence against him, of tying him up, of forcing him to kiss the feet of the princess. And he's accusing the princess of having ordered him to do this. I mean, there are even more lurid details that have appeared in the French press. He says he did take a photo, but it was in order to help him with his work. The implication, though, from the princess's side is that he was taking a photo either of her. Now, there are almost no photos of her whatsoever, so that would possibly be something that would be saleable, or of the apartment itself. The bodyguard has said that, yes, he did manhandle Ashraf Eid, but it was in order to protect the princess. The princess has not appeared. She was invited to appear by video conference. She said no. There's an international warrant issued by the French. So for those reasons, the Saudis have said there was no way she could appear in court.
Sebastian Usher. Freedom of the press has been deteriorating around the world over the past decade, according to monitoring groups. Hundreds of journalists were in prison and last year dozens were killed. A conference on media freedom is being held in London on Wednesday. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucet, has been to Hungary, where there's been a dramatic transformation in the media landscape.
A gorgeous summer's day on the River Danube. Boats, cars, cyclists gliding past. And on the other side, the majestic parliament, one of the largest in the world, the biggest symbol of democracy here. And over the past decade, since Viktor Orban swept to power, he's used the tools in a democracy to consolidate his power. His playbook includes the press, dominating the media landscape, including the advertising revenue to run it. I've been speaking to his top spokesman, an opposition politician, and a journalist to find out more about media freedom.
My name is Andrzej Petu. I'm a co-founder and one of the editors of Direct 36, an investigative reporting center based in Budapest. The space for independent journalism has been shrinking quite rapidly. In Hungary, we have a hostile political climate as well. This creates this toxic mix. So a lot of potential sources are afraid of giving information to journalists.
So you were filming that?
Yes, actually, that door is over there.
I'm standing outside the headquarters of Hungarian State TV, and I'm here with Bernadette Sale, who's a member of parliament, opposition, and you were listening to the video that she, I think, bravely filmed when they were basically thrown out of State TV.
We just wanted to get in and talk to the director of news, because demonstrations were everywhere in Hungary. They were happening, and it was not on news. And we wanted to get real news on Hungarian public television and radio.
State TV matters a lot to Viktor Orban.
Absolutely, because majority of the people, you know, get information, or I would rather say disinformation, from this television and radio. That is why we want to change this, and that's why we came here, because this is not fair.
On air at ATV, an independent TV station. But across Hungary, more and more media are now coming under the government sway. Some watchdogs say it's as much as 80%. A new foundation groups nearly 500 media, all state-friendly. Media barons on the right side get the government's advertising and contracts, putting pressure on other private media to censor or sell. That's the playbook of Viktor Orban. populist and popular prime minister, consolidating power with his nationalist anti-immigration message. His chief spokesman, Zoltan Kovac.
The government has nothing to do with the control of the media. Our media system, our media regulatory system, is up to the European standards.
You accept that there's been a consolidation of control, either directly or indirectly, by supporters of the government who champion certain values in a certain direction for Hungary.
That's not what I suggested. What I suggested is there was a consolidation by this foundation in the ownership of the media, which is national. It does not suppose pro-government or anti-government.
But it
means
that
it's Hungarian.
The values that Prime Minister Orbán would like to promote for Hungary.
For the moment, that's right. I mean, but the thing is that why is it a problem?
And this is democracy on the Danube, and neighbours are taking note. Poland is interested in Prime Minister Orbán's playbook. So is Austria's right-wing Freedom Party. They all think media freedom matters. They just want to be free to control it.
Lizzie Sett reporting from Budapest. The British broadcaster Sir David Attenborough has warned that climate change could cause a significant increase in migration from Africa and that a failure to act would bring great social unrest. He was giving evidence to a committee of British MPs. Our environment correspondent Matt McGrath has the details.
Painting a vivid picture for MPs of coral reefs turned stark white by warming waters, Sir David warned that the world faced a serious collapse caused by climate change over the next 20 to 30 years. This could lead to mass migration to Europe from uninhabitable parts of Africa, he said, and problems like this would happen inexorably. He criticised those governments where voices sceptical about climate science were still clearly heard, and he hoped voters would remember this come election time.
I am sorry that there are people who are in power, notably, of course, the United States, but also in Australia, which is extraordinary, actually, because Australia is already having to deal with some of the most extreme manifestations of climate change. Both Australia and America, those voices are clearly heard. One hopes that the electorate will actually respond to those.
So David told MPs that everyone would have to play their part in the battle against climate change, and this would involve some tough decisions. He said airfares should rise to discourage flying. The public mood, he said, was changing, much like it had in the 19th century with slavery. The young in particular, he said, gave him hope.
I suspect that we are right now in the beginning of a big change. Young people, particularly, are the stimulus that's bringing that about, in which members of the public are understanding that to have the nerve to say, this is our rubbish, and then we'll give you money, and if you can spend it on your land instead of ours in the Far East, is intolerable. Young people see that very clearly now, and that's a source of great hope to me.
Despite the stark nature of his message, Sir David's passion and status certainly charmed the MPs on the committee. One described it as the most inspiring session that they've held.
Matt McGrath. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Stephanie Prentice. Until next time, goodbye.